Welcome to the Pop Culture Pub Podcast. Now let's begin.
Listener, and welcome to the Pop Culture Pub Podcast. I am your host this week. My name is Chris Lockhart, and this evening I have both my co-hosts in crime here. So first up, he's the Robin to my Batman, and that's Mr. Kevin Deesett. How's it going, Kevin?
Oh, it's going good. I didn't expect that one. Now I'm wondering which Robin.
I'm thinking Tim Drake. Although, I guess, technically, he's not considered Robin anymore. But anyway, I digress.
Red Robin and now Drake, which is a terrible new name, but it's kind of weird.
Yes.
Does anyone look like Damian Wayne? I do.
And last but not least, we have Mr. Jason Roberts, who is the Mr. Spock to my Captain Kirk. How's it going, Jason?
It's going pretty good. Thank you.
Excellent. All right, so for this episode, we are going to reminisce about the times we were geek-blocked. And by that, I mean the times when, for whatever reason, we were denied, you know, a certain pop culture resolution, or we weren't allowed to go to the theater because we were too drunk, or whatever the case may be. Before we get into that, I have a random fact here, and this is something I wanted to bring back to the podcast. This is something I used to do when I hosted the Random Nerdness podcast. I would always start the episode with a random fact. And did you know, on September 9th, 2013, Sir Patrick Stewart, better known as Captain Picard, or Professor X, married jazz singer Sonny Ozell in a ceremony conducted by Sir Ian McKellen, also known as Magneto or Gandalf. So, they're besties. Like, I think it's so cool that, you know, like, they did the first X-Men movie, and apparently they, I guess, met a couple times before that, but never really developed a serious relationship, but it was filming the first X-Men movie when they became buddies. You know, like, because apparently they used to, like, go to each other's, you know, trailers on set and drink tea, and they would talk, and they realized, hey, we got a lot in common here. And they became really good friends. And, you know, so much so that Ian McKellen actually married Patrick Stewart to his wife. And I just think that's so cool that Professor X and Magneto in real life would be best buds.
two things. You could switch Ian McKellen and the wife's name in that story. You could switch the names and the roles, and I'd still believe that story.
Right.
If Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen got married, I'd believe it at this point. But them hanging out, this is my McDonald's coffee theory. And that is, when you go into a McDonald's and you see the older gentleman hanging out and talking and having their coffee, mm-hmm. I wonder, have these guys been friends since they were in like their teens, 20s, 30s, or are they just like, hey, you're still alive and I'm still alive, and we're about the same age, so we should probably talk because I got no one left to talk to.
From what I understand,
so Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart being the only two around that same age on that movie set, we're going to be drawn to each other no matter what.
Well, and plus, with them both being English, of course. But from what I understand, like, I believe they did act together, like, in the same productions, like, back in England, like, in theater and and so on. But they never really were buddies. Like, they never really hung out. But, like, yeah, it's because they were at doing the X-Men movie at the same time. They're like, hey, you know, wanna have a tea and hang and talk. And actually, when you're talking about, you know, switching the roles and stuff, a guy I work with actually asked me that. He's like, are they like a couple or something? Because there is pictures of them kissing, you know, and it's not, you know, like the French, you know, where you kiss each other on the cheek or whatever. It's, yeah, that's lip on lip kissing. They're that good of friends, I guess. But no, they're you know, Ian McKellen is gay, but Patrick Stewart is not. He is married to a lady. So, but you know, I can understand why people might be confused by some of the pictures you see of them out there. But yeah, I just thought that was such a neat friendship, you know, that they have. All right, well, let's move on to our main topic, which is the times we were geek blocked. So I'll kick it off. The one way that I've been, and guys, feel free to chime in if you have anything that's applicable to anything that I bring up or anything you guys bring up. One of the times that I've been geek blocked, and this has happened on a few times, it's when TV shows are canceled on a cliffhanger. You know, the new Dallas show that came out a few years ago, you know, with the original cast coming back and with new cast members, they literally, I think they went 2 seasons, I think, or maybe it was 3 seasons. And anyway, the last season ended with Bobby's son seemingly getting blown up in a car. And that's it. You know, it just ended abruptly, and...
Sure it wasn't a nightmare this time?
I don't know. I wish I did. You know, because I was actually enjoying that show. You know, it was great seeing all the, you know, not all of them, but a lot of the original series actors coming back. It was great seeing JR back and seeing, you know, them writing his real life death into the show. It's kind of neat how they did that, because he knew he was dying, and so they actually wrote that into the show in a way that made sense. But then, yeah, all of a sudden the show gets canceled, and we don't know what happens to Bobby's son. Also, the 2002 He-Man series, the one that I think it was Cartoon Network did. I really liked that series. I thought, you know, the relaunch of Masters of the Universe in a modern, you know, the modern take that they took with it, you know, but at the same time paying homage to the original series, was brilliant. I really enjoyed it. And then all of a sudden it was just done. It was over with, and, you know, like, you know, they were building up to something and unfortunately never got the chance to pay off because it was canceled. So yeah, that's my first example of geek blocked TV shows being canceled on a cliffhanger. And I guess that He-Man show didn't really have a cliffhanger. It did leave some things unresolved, but, yeah. Anyway, Kevin, I'll throw it over to you. What's an example of a time that you were geek blocked?
Okay, quick question. Did, Larry Hagman's eyebrows make it onto the new Dallas show?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, I was completely blanking on JR, the name of JR is the actor. Yes, Larry Hagman, yeah. And like I said, they wrote his illness into the show in a brilliant way that worked. And it actually created a mystery for, you know, that was resolved on the season two finale. But anyway, I digress. Kevin, go ahead.
Okay. So I'm going bigger than TV shows getting canceled. I'm going for the whole, it's a new season, here's a new show lineup. Because the worst one of it would be after school, you rush home, you sit down to watch something, and it's like first, second week of school, or maybe it's the, you know, coming into January, or maybe school hasn't started yet, but you're out on your bike and you rush home to watch your favorite cartoon. Mm-hmm. You turn on the channel and you hear Thundercats no longer airs at this time. The hell? What do you mean it no longer airs? So you're flipping around. Where is it, on another channel right now? No. Let me get out the TV guide. Thundercats isn't on anywhere anymore. What's going on? And that's how many of us learned how TV works. Mm-hmm. And that there are seasons, there are cancellations and renewals, but you would have, you know, your Saturday morning lineup and your after school lineup. And I had like, for after school, we had like two channels that would both play cartoons, and you kind of bounce back and forth. And if you're lucky, there's not two shows on at the same time that you want to watch. If you're not lucky, you're like, okay, if one's the repeat, I'm watching the other. But then shows get canceled, TV stations want, you know, think there's a better, more profitable show or something else they could put on there. But that was heartbreaking when I was a kid. Your favorite show is gone. Mm-hmm. And for all kids listening to podcasts now, we didn't have YouTube we could get on. We didn't have streaming we could get it. We didn't have a TiVo or DVR that you could just go through your recordings. Like, it was gone. It was gone. That was it. Your favorite TV show is no longer around. If you missed episodes, oh well. If it ended on a cliffhanger, which a lot of those 80s cartoons had, like, 5-episode mini-movies once a season at least, if not more. If you missed one, oh well, not going to see it again. And at the time, none of us could have guessed what would come with, you know, Netflix and YouTube and, you know, all points in between. Mm-hmm. We really thought we would never have the opportunity to see it again. I remember finding, like, there were kids that would tape the cartoons, and you would have, like, a little tape borrowing, tape trading thing in grade school of, like, oh my gosh, I missed part 4 of this 5-part G.I. Joe epic, and someone had taped it, so you're all borrowing the same tape.
Yeah.
That's how most of us learned of cancellation. It was awful.
Yeah, it just wasn't there. Like, and that's exactly how I found out about He-Man. Like, when the original He-Man stopped airing, all of a sudden it wasn't there anymore. And I would later find out it was on another channel, but we didn't get that channel. Like, it wasn't available in my area. Yeah. And yeah, it was tough. Like, for years, you know, like, He-Man, for example, you know, it wasn't until I was, like, I don't know, 25 or something, when they started re-releasing them on DVD. Prior to that, it was, like, old VHS tapes that were released in the late 80s. Like, that was, like, the last of that you saw of He-Man.
And, like, 3 episodes tops, usually only mm-hmm. 2.
Yep.
And certainly not a complete collection. So you might be like, okay, I haven't watched it in a while. Let me just watch these 2 random episodes to get, you know, a little bit of a fix.
Yep.
And, but nowhere near a season set by any means.
And, of course, you know, at the time, being a little kid, you know, like, the things you remember from certain episodes, is that really what happened? Like, or, you know, were you just in your mind, did you embellish it a little bit? Did things not quite happen as you remembered them? You know, it was tough. It was absolutely tough. But, yeah. Kids these days will not know the struggle that we had to endure. But, excellent one there, Kev. Jason, what's first on your list, sir?
Mine wasn't so much of a, like, canceled. I still kick myself to this day. It's not like a canceled TV show or something. It was, It was a while ago. It's one of my friends. His name's Eric Pygor, and he does animation stuff for Disney. And he kind of went off and did his own thing. And he makes a lot of these horror movie themed, like old school monsters, kind of mix them with a little bit of new school, like, you know, like cartoons. And he was also really good friends with Bob Camp, a few of the other artists too, from SpongeBob SquarePants. I still refuse to watch that show, but I do appreciate the artists. But and then there's a few of the other artists and stuff from the guys who did Ren and Stimpy that were at the party there too. It was on Halloween. It was also him and his wife's anniversary too. So that's kind of setting the whole tone. And they were like, I was just kind of geeking out because these guys are kind of like, you know, I love the cartoons, and they had such a rich history of knowledge of like the old school Looney Tunes and how things were. Mm-hmm. And so it was like a real chance to kind of sit there and just start picking, you know, just pulling apart their brains and just figuring out what, you know, what they went through. And like Bob Camp was really awesome to meet. And I met him last year's Comic-Con too. And I talked to him some more, and I realized that him and I actually grew up in the same town of Ojai, California. We ran in the same circles, but we never met. And it was kind of funny. And so it's like, we'd sit there and talk, and it turned into a simple, like, hey, how are you? Kind of get your autograph, you know, turned into like almost like a 3-hour conversation. And we, at some point in the middle of, you know, the Comic-Con, we started singing, was it the Ren and Stimpy, the Canadian Kilt, was it Kilted Yaksman song? Like right in the middle of Comic-Con. And it wasn't just quiet. I mean, like, we're bellowing it, you know, and it was the stipulation he had. He goes, I won't charge you for the autograph if you sing the song with me. And I'm like, okay, fine. So I wound up doing it. That, besides that point, that was off on a tangent there. Going back to the party, it got kind of late at night. This was in Burbank, California. I lived in San Luis Obispo, California. And that's, depending on traffic, that's about a three-hour drive. And I had work at like 6 in the morning the following day. And at one point, they're just kind of like, oh, I have a friend who's having a big Halloween party, and they really want to go. And it's like, okay, where is it? He's like, well, it's more further into, like, you know, the Hollywood Hill area. And he goes, well, it's Rob Zombie's house. And I'm like, are you serious? And he's like, yeah, we just go over there and just come, like, how do you? And I'm like, and I was torn. And like, I have that, because I knew if I went, I would not be going to work the following day or the day after that. And I'm just kind of like, I was torn, you know, like financial responsibilities or have some really awesome memories and stories. And unfortunately, I don't want to say reasonable side, but the financial side won. And I said no. And I went home to an empty house. To this day, I'm like, ugh. And I think what makes matters worse is I wound up quitting that job about 3 weeks later.
Oh, yeah.
So that just kind of like that salt on the wound type deal. And it's just like that, there's that what if that I could have just had a total geek out moment. And no, I robbed myself. Mm-hmm.
It happens, especially, yeah, when you got to weigh in fiscal responsibility, you know, like when, you know, you have to eat, you know, unfortunately, you know,
yeah.
Food requires money to pay for it. Yeah, I've been there. Like, yeah, there's been times like I could have done something, but I couldn't because I had work or whatever, right? Missed opportunities for sure. Excellent. All right, so next on my list, I'm just time's being geek blocked. So we're going back to 2003, I believe this is when this film was released, and that's X2, the second X-Men movie. I was so excited to go see this movie. You know, I really enjoyed the first X-Men movie. Really liked what I was reading about the X2 movie. So I get my ticket, I get into the theater, I'm sitting down, and there's a woman that's sitting beside me. I have no idea who she is, never met her a day before that, I don't think I've seen her after that, I have no idea who she is. The whole time during this movie, she talked. And she wasn't even just, because she was sitting beside a friend, and you could, like, her friend wasn't talking back. But it's like she went into this movie and to basically, like, just yap and make jokes the whole time. And she wasn't even quiet about it. Like, she was, talking normally, like you would talk, like usually when you're in a movie theater, like if you have to say something to your friend or whatever, your spouse, you do it quietly. You talk at a reduced volume. But she didn't. She was talking just as loud as the screen people were, it seemed. And I've never had that experience in my life where someone, and she was laughing at parts that weren't funny, and she was pointing out, things that didn't make sense. And it was, without a doubt, the worst audience member I've ever seen at a theater. And I was sitting beside her. And the problem is, especially back, like nowadays, I'm kind of a grumpy old man now. If I went to a movie theater, I would say something. I would turn to her and tell her to shut the fuck up. But back when I was, 23 years old, I was a little bit more shy, and I just bit my lip and endured this for, 2 hours. And like I said, the worst movie audience member I've ever encountered in my life. And then I watched, I want to say it was Scary Movie 2, where the actress, I can't remember who it was in the movie theater, and that's her character. She's the annoying person in the movie theater, right? And then the scary movie guy is trying to kill her, but she's so annoying to all the other movie patrons that all the other movie patrons take a turn at stabbing her. And the killer just sits back and was like, oh, I guess I don't have to do anything. And he kind of, laughs about it. That was that woman. Like, she was that annoying. Like, that was exactly what I experienced, is that level of annoyance. But, totally destroyed my enjoyment of that movie. And, I can't remember if I went to the theater again to watch it or if I just waited till it came out on DVD. But I thoroughly enjoyed the movie eventually. But that initial enjoyment, like, I was waiting for this movie, this is before I had the internet, honestly. I was reading about it in probably like Starlog and those type of magazines. I was getting psyched up for this movie. And then she just ruined it. Absolutely ruined it. So that is number two on my list for being geek blocked. Kevin, what is number two on your list, sir?
All right. Have I done the Star Wars Episode 1 story on here before? You can think of?
Not that I can recall. But if you have, that's fine.
Yeah. So, Star Wars Episode 1 coming out, and granted, looking back, all of us have our issues with it, although a lot of that seems to be coming back around now. But in the lead up to it, this was the biggest movie ever for, or so we thought it was going to be. Went up to the mall, 2 weeks before a movie was out, never bought advance tickets before in my life or since, like this.
Mm-hmm.
Waited in line, got my tickets, made plans with one of my best friends, drive up, go see the show.
Mm-hmm.
So show is 7:30, let's say, when we have tickets for. Get there about 7:20, get our tickets, go in. I go, oh, theater's full. It's sold out. I'm like, yeah, where it's sold out? Bought my tickets 2 weeks ago. Got them right here. No, there's no seats left. Right. And two of those seats are mine, mm-hmm. so they're probably empty. But, you know, there's none left to buy. And they're like, no, people showed up late for the 7 o'clock show, so they're in the 7:30 show. We'll kick them out. Well, we can't do that. We don't know who has tickets for which show. Well, you look at the tickets. Theater just didn't want to bother with it. So they're like, well, you can go into the 7 o'clock show. All right, well, that being my only other option here, I guess, I went in. So the movie's already started. Missed the entire opening. Seating in terrible seats because it's all that was left. And then it ends up being episode one as well. So just massive disappointment of the whole situation. And it rippled out. I saw, let me think here. I saw episode two in theater like 3 weeks after it came out, and I never saw episode three in theater. I finally watched it when it came out on home video.
Mm.
Like, just
yeah,
soured me to the whole experience.
So with episode one, did you know immediately after you saw it that it was bad?
I didn't. When did it come out?
99.
No, I mean like about month wise.
May. May.
Wait, what is May? Okay.
I want to say third weekend in May. It was, I believe, the long weekend in May for the in the States.
Okay.
Which I think is a third weekend for you guys, or fourth weekend. I can't remember.
But. Yeah. So I saw my uncle shortly after, and you know, we all kind of have that uncle that sees every movie and, you know, has their own little home theater collection and stuff like that.
Yep.
So I saw him shortly after, probably like, you know, someone was graduating, you know, had to graduate from next month or something like that.
Yep.
He's like, well, did you see it? Yeah, I saw it. How many times did you see it? Well, I saw it the one time and it wasn't, you know, that good an experience and all. I haven't gone back. And he said, that tells me everything I need to know. He's like, you're the biggest geek I know. You're the biggest Star Wars fan I know. You're the biggest person I know into this, all of this world, you know, all of this stuff. And you've only watched it once. That means I don't need to bother with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to defend it because I was still working through the feelings about it. So I'm like, no, it wasn't that bad. It wasn't that. I'm like, he has a point.
Mm-hmm.
Because if this was, I mean, now I'm not going to see a movie twice, more financial and just having the free time for it.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, I saw movies I didn't like three or four times. So a movie I loved, I would have gone and seen again. And I wasn't ready for him to, you know, hit me with that reality. But he was just saying the fact that I only saw it once told him everything he needed to know about it. And that was me, you know, being hit with a reality I wasn't ready to accept yet. That this movie just is not for me. It's not doing something for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to believe because Star Wars was huge while all of us were growing up, but this just was not going to be the same no matter what.
Yeah, and for me, it took, like, honestly, like, I remember I went and seen it, and then, like, because my theater that I went and seen at was, like, a 2.5-hour drive away, so I drove home, and I was still living at home at the time, so my mom asked me, you know, so did you like it? What'd you think? And I was like, I don't know. Like, I really had to sit and I had to process it for a few weeks before I realized it really was not that good.
Yeah, because we wanted to believe that it was going to be.
Yes, and
you know, we knew the flaws in the first three, but could accept it with love.
Yeah. But anyway, all right. Well, let's move on to Jason, the next on your list, sir.
Oh goodness. I'm probably trying to think of what would be a good show that there's just a lot. I think one of them, I was really in when sci-fi, of course, and when I say sci-fi, it's like saying Fox, and you automatically know a show is doomed when you bring up those two names.
Yep.
And one of them was, there's the show Eureka, and then they had Warehouse 13. And I loved Warehouse 13. Mm-hmm. And I love both shows, actually, but I liked Warehouse 13 more. And I especially enjoyed the crossover episodes. And I remember, I think Warehouse got into 5 seasons?
I believe so.
And I remember just watching it just constantly. And then I kind of lost touch with the last season. I got halfway through it. And then I thought there would be more. But they stopped airing it. And I know they have more episodes, like almost 5 or 6 more episodes after from where I left off. Mm-hmm. But then they canceled the show, but they didn't bother airing the rest of the episodes. And now it's just like, it's literally that scratch you can't get to. And I'm trying to, like, for a while there too, was even worse, was like Netflix had Warehouse 13, but they only had season 3. And so it was just kind of like, I'm trying to find it, like on Amazon, if I can just buy it, the whole series outright, but they want like an arm and a leg for it. Mm-hmm. And it's been one of those shows that just kind of like, it never ended for me. And it's got very, very frustrated.
That is frustrating.
I believe that was one of these spread to the actors too. I don't even think the actors realized it was going to end.
No, from my understanding, it was very abrupt. It was kind of like that Firefly syndrome. Like, no, everyone thought it was going to go on, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, no, you're canceled.
And it's so weird because sci-fi is so famous for canceling stuff that is seemingly doing good. You know, like The Expanse, like season 3 was a good season. The first, all 3 seasons were good on that show. And then they're like, no, yeah, we're done. They're throwing in the towel. Thank God for Amazon. You know, thank God they stepped in. You know, like, they made a shorter season with season 4, but it was just as good, if actually not better in some ways. But, like, honestly, even, like, Battlestar Galactica, like, I really think it wasn't supposed to end at season 4. Like, I think they told Ron Moore after season 3, like, yeah, we're only doing one more, buddy. Like, you need to wrap it up, right? Like, I really think that Battlestar could have went at least another season, and I think it was supposed to. Like, I'm sure they had a 5-year plan in place, and then all of a sudden sci-fi, for whatever reason, I don't know why they do this. You know, like, they invest in these shows, you know, they want the viewers to watch it, and then all of a sudden they just pull the plug, seemingly out of nowhere.
Yeah.
But sorry.
And Kevin, it's ridiculous because, yeah, sci-fi is like the bastard child, because USA is in their same umbrella, mm-hmm. and USA will get shows for years and give them a chance to be successful. Burn Notice, Psych, White Collar. You know, there's more I can't.
Was it like,
I just can't think of off the top of my head. Yeah, well, but they're given a chance to run, and sci-fi is just, no, you're done.
Well, and USA, they've even taken in shows like Law & Order Criminal Intent. Like, they actually brought that, like, NBC was done with that show. USA took it, because they're owned by NBC, I believe. And they did, I want to say, 2 or 3 more seasons of Criminal Intent, and they were good. Like, you know, like, they had Jeff Goldblum on it. They had Chris Noth. You know, like, they really did a good job. And it's so weird that, like, sci-fi is, like, the exact opposite, but yet they're
yeah,
the same company. Must be different creative officers or something in control.
Yeah.
But all right, well, let's go around the table one more time. If you guys have another one on your list, the next on my list is, and again, you guys feel free to jump in if you have something similar. Comic books being canceled mid arc or creators being squeezed out. This happens all the time in comic books, unfortunately. You know, I've mentioned, you know, Peter David's run on the Incredible Hulk in previous episodes. He had a plan to go to issue 500. Issue 500 was supposed to be his final episode, or sorry, final issue. But unfortunately, Marvel editorial wanted to go a different approach, you know, to the Hulk. They wanted to go back to the Savage Hulk, the, you know, Hulk smash, you know, Bruce Banner gets angry, turns into the Hulk. They wanted to go that route. Peter David was telling, you know, a Hulk story with a more intelligent Hulk at the time. And he abruptly ended his run with issue 467. And it was going in a very interesting direction. And I know he was building up to this, I think it was called the Hell on Earth War or something like that. And I know it was going to involve Mephisto. It was going to involve, you know, the Hulk's future alter ego, the Maestro. You know, he was, you know, doing all this building up to, you know, this big final story arc that he wanted to tell, with it concluding with issue 500, which was going to be his last issue. That's when he was going to bow out. But for whatever reason, Marvel, you know, decided they wanted to take this approach. And I don't have the data here, but from what I've been told, it was the biggest drop in Marvel sales is when Peter David's run ended. And then I think Joe Casey took over, and he did an all right job taking over for Peter for the last, you know, whatever. I think they went to issue 475 with Joe Casey, and then it got the title itself got canceled, and then they relaunched it simply as the Hulk with John Byrne writing, with Ron Garney doing the art, and it was a Savage Hulk story line. But from what I was told, it was like the biggest drop in sales in like modern Marvel history. Like the Incredible Hulk under Peter David's run was one of their top selling books, and then the Hulk ended up becoming one of the lowest selling books for them. And I think John Byrne only lasted like, I think, 18 issues or something before he quit.
Oh, wow.
So it sucks, you know, like, it, you know, like this guy had this long term plan and basically got screwed out of it, and the fans got screwed at the same time. Also with Marvel, Chris Claremont, back in the early 90s, you know, the artists were basically running the store, you know, like Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld and Todd McFarlane and, you know, all these guys that would later go on to found Image were the top guys at Marvel, right? Like, traditionally Marvel had been more of a writer's playground in the sense that the writers kind of dictated the direction books would go and how things would play out. But in the 90s, when you had all these art, you know, these hotshot artists coming in, you know, books were selling, you know, based on more on the art than the writing. So, you know, Jim Lee and all these other artists wanted to take the X-Men in a different direction. And Chris Claremont was like, no, I don't want to go that way. So basically, it came down to, you know, editorial choosing between their writer or their artists, and unfortunately, they felt that, you know, the art was selling the books more than the story. So Chris Claremont basically got squeezed out of the X-Men. And like Louise Simonson, she got basically squeezed out of the New Mutants because Rob Liefeld wanted to turn the New Mutants into, you know, more of a action, you know, guns and pouches type of comic book rather than, you know, like a teen drama type of book, which is what the New Mutants were. And then they became X-Force, you know, they became like this black ops team. And then, you know, the irony being that all these top artists at Marvel ended up jumping ship anyway, and you know, flipping the middle finger at Marvel on their way out the door to form their own company. And I know Chris Claremont has been quoted as saying, like, if he would have just stuck it out for a few more months, he would have ended up, you know, running the show again. But he didn't, and he left, and he ended up going to DC and so on. And he did come back in the early 2000s. He came back to the X-Men, and unfortunately, he just didn't have it anymore. Like, he just, his second coming to the X-Men just honestly kind of sucked. It was not good. And then another instance of, you know, creators being, he wasn't really squeezed out, but Gary Frank, you know, he was the artist on The Incredible Hulk from issue 403 to 425. He did the first half of 425. And he missed, you know, the odd issue here and there. You know, they would bring in a fill-in artist from time to time. But Gary Frank, like, in my opinion, Gary Frank, art he did on the Hulk is the best art he's ever done. Like, he's one of my favorite artists, but his stuff on the Hulk is absolutely amazing. And then, of course, paired with Peter David, you know, like, it was a dream team. And then halfway through 425, he was gone, and he was replaced by Liam Sharp, who, in my opinion, this is my opinion, is not a good artist. I really don't like his stuff. And then they turned the Hulk kind of into a, like, because it was part of the Marvel Edge line. Like, it was, like, the darker corner of the Marvel Universe now. So they took the Hulk in kind of, like, a horror book route, which, ironically, is what they're doing now with the Immortal Hulk. But they seem to be doing a better job, you know, in 2020 with the Immortal Hulk than they did back in the mid-90s. But unfortunately, for whatever reason, I don't know if that was a decision they made. Like, they wanted to make the Hulk darker, so they brought in this other artist, and Gary Frank, you know, left. I don't know what happened, but I just remember the Hulk. I just remember being so sad. Like, I was such a sad fan, and it took a long time before, you know, they really found a good artist. Like Adam Kubert came and actually was very good, you know, a few years later. But yeah, from time to time in comic books, you know, you get this where creators are forced to leave, or they choose to leave, or, you know, comic books are canceled mid-arc, and yeah, it's just the nature of the industry, unfortunately. But that is the number three on my list. So Kevin, I'll throw it over to you. What do you have on your list?
All right, I got comic one too, but just to double back.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
The funny thing is, and I was right there with all the other kids, you know, let me put down all Image on my pull list and get everything from all the hot artists.
Mm-hmm.
And you gotta blame Wizard to a point of constant articles of what's more important in the comic, the writing or the art. Clearly, mm-hmm. they're going with artists. Because Image made Wizard.
Mm-hmm.
But I ended up dropping every one of those books, for the most part, because the writing was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually got to a point where I'm like, okay, the book's pretty, the ones that still were, the ones that still had, you know, the artist trying, even if they were at least replaced with a good artist. But I'm like, I've been reading 12, 20, however many issues of this book, and I couldn't tell you who the people are in it. That's not mm-hmm. a good sign. You know, clearly something's missing here.
I find for me, I can stick with a comic book if the writing is good and the art is bad. But I can't stick with a comic book if the art is good but the writing's bad. Like, the writing has to be good either way.
I've dropped many... I've dropped many comics because the writing's bad. I've only dropped a comic once because the art is bad.
Yeah.
And it was just so terrible. I was like, I'm done with this. This was a waste of money. Mm-hmm. I'm actually upset about it. But for my own pick for comic one, little explanation will be needed, is I'm picking Wanted. And my understanding is the first issue of Wanted came out, and that issue was immediately bought up and optioned as a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the terrible movie with the bending bullets in mid-flight and the loom, and it tells you the future and everything.
Yeah.
Because all they had was the first issue to go off of, and they just came up with something from there. Whereas the actual full story in the graphic novel is amazing and a great story of here are your villains and they're awful and you shouldn't root for them and that's our main character. And then it turns out there's worse than him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that he's a good guy or anyone around him is a good guy. It's just that there is worse evil than this evil. And so he's our protagonist. I'm like, What a messed up idea. And there's so many great concepts in that and twists and turns, and I loved it. And that movie is just a steaming pile. And all from the original, both come from one issue source. And they mm-hmm. couldn't be more different in quality. But I was hoping, I saw the commercials, I was hoping maybe this movie is showing all this stuff to get people in there, then we're going to go, you know, like the comic and, you know, throw in the big horrible bad guy from the comic and do this and that. Nope. Nothing. Not an ounce of comic left in that movie. And I couldn't have been more disappointed in it.
Yeah, I hear you. Like, yeah, there's nothing worse than a movie adaption of something and you think it's going to be good. And it's really not.
No, and I can accept ones that just, like, hey, they didn't hit the mark for whatever reason. The Punisher movies are not perfect by any means.
Yeah.
Jonah Hex. But there's at least, okay, there's at least the source material still there.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, all right, you swung and you missed, but. You know, my comic love is still there on screen. There is nothing of that comic left. Mm-hmm. Like, to the point of that Wanted movie should just be called something different. You know, Bendy Bullets. I don't know. Something else.
Yeah.
Because it's got nothing to do. And that's why it's like, I'm not going to buy it. I don't count it as a comic movie. And I'll be broad with that, you know, genre in my head. But that one's just... If the movie becomes forgotten, I'd be happy. And it's a shame, because the comic's fantastic, and that's, I don't know, because Grant Morrison supposedly, was it Morrison?
Or was it Mark Millar? I can't remember.
It was Mark Millar, sorry.
Okay.
That's why Mark Millar has a deal with Netflix that we're supposed to see something anytime now,
mm-hmm.
but rumor was Wanted, he got the rights back, and he wanted to do it again. And, I mean, who knows? Because that deal was like 2 or 3 years ago now at this point, and we've yet to see anything from it.
Yeah, or maybe it might be one of those projects that just comes out of nowhere. Like when the Umbrella Academy came out, I did not realize that was a thing until it was like, oh, guess what's coming to Netflix? Oh, cool. And it was
Lock and Key got dropped out of nowhere.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
The Cloverfield movie, yeah. Netflix will surprise us. And you know what? With all going on in the world, this would be a perfect time for Netflix to surprise us all. Yes. Hey, you're stuck at home. Here's something cool to watch.
Yes. Yeah, I'm hoping Disney will fast-track that Falcon and the Winter Soldier show release, because, yeah, I'd like to watch that. Especially with all these movies getting delayed now. Like, it would be awesome if they were like, okay, these movies are getting delayed, so we're going to start launching these shows a little bit early for you.
Well, someone posted an idea. They said, what if we all got together for, like, South by Southwest and had, like, Netflix or Amazon Prime do South by Your Couch? And all the movies that were going to be at these film festivals that now aren't going to get exposure and aren't going to get bought and aren't going to get wide release, you do like a Netflix or Prime. Hey, for 1 week, all these movies are on here. We'll do the convention from the comfort of your home. And then after a week, these movies are gone. If you want them again, you got support. It's not a bad idea.
No, that sounds great to me. Yeah. But, all right. Well, excellent pick there, Kevin. Unfortunately, Jason had to step away. I'm not sure if he's coming back. So I'll throw another one out there, and then we'll move on to our next next segment. All right. I was going to mention the times that you're geek blocked at Comic Cons. And there's so many examples of this. I know I've mentioned a few of these before. Like, you know, you go and you stand in line for a photo op, and then you're the line's moving forward, and then, okay, line's over. You know, we're moving on. You know, the celebrity needs to do something else, and you've just sat in line for 3 hours just to have them tell you you're not getting your picture with your celebrity. I know at one Calgary Comic Con I went to, they actually oversold the convention. So much so that the fire marshal in Calgary actually showed up and said, no one is allowed to come in to this convention anymore today, and anyone that leaves is not allowed back in. And at first they were not announcing this to people. So, you know, like when I attend a convention, what I do is I'll go into the dealer's room or whatever and buy the comics I want or the collectibles or whatever. And then I'll usually run them out to my car and put them in my car so I don't have to carry them around the convention the whole time. Well, that's what a lot of people do. So people were going outside to put stuff in their vehicles or to go out for a cigarette or whatever. And then they weren't being allowed back in. And they paid, they paid their ticket, they paid to be there, and the convention organizers basically locked the doors and were like, nope, you're not coming back in. And some of these people, you know, like paid for photo ops for later in the day or paid, to do this or that, and now they couldn't, you know, because they were literally locked out. Unfortunately, fortunately, in the case for the Calgary convention is they've learned from this and they actually have this really awesome system now where, you get, basically it's like a key card. They have people at the doors with tablets and you basically, tap the tablet with your key card and it logs that you're in the building. When you leave, you tap it again, so it logs when you've left. So they know exactly how many people are in the convention at any given time. And they've actually moved a lot of the events and stuff to other buildings and to the outside, weather permitting, of course, to help control the amount of people that are actually in the main building. So they've come a long way. And unfortunately, in 2012, that was a learning curve for them. And fortunately, I didn't get locked out. Like, fortunately, I heard about this, so I knew not to go outside. The unfortunate thing is that now when I'm going to my photo ops and I'm going to, the autograph lines or whatever, I have to carry around everything I bought for the day, all day, until I decide to leave. You know, it's so that was an example of definitely being geek blocked. Fortunately, I wasn't one of them that, you know, got locked out, but I could have been easily.
Yeah.
But, all right, well, let's move on to our next segment, and that is Brain Candy. Now, with our Brain Candy segment, we take one thing that you have been watching or reading, and we discuss it. And I should mention that, unfortunately, Jason had to leave, so he is no longer with us on this episode, going forward. So, Kevin, what is something that you've been watching or reading lately?
I'm trying to think how to say it without totally spoiling it. So, I have been reading a lot of Hulk lately to try to get ideas. No, actually, it's public out there. Trying to think here if it was out or not. I'm sorry, Chris, I'm cheating on you a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Next week, there is a podcast called Sequel Quest. It's over on the Retro Network, which I write for.
Okay.
And they will take a movie that never got a sequel and do roundtable. Everyone comes with ideas for the sequel for it.
Oh, cool.
And they'll kind of vote on who has the best pitch. In my mind, the Ferris Bueller one has been their best so far. Like, I had chills listening to one of the pitches. I'm like, I would give someone $20 right now to watch that movie. Their idea is amazing. So coming up, they're going to do a pitch a sequel to the Ed Norton Incredible Hulk movie.
Oh. And
I will be appearing on this with my own idea. So I've been reading Hulk comics recently, trying to get some ideas going for what could fit into a sequel to that movie. Do you just go as a straight-up sequel to that Ed Norton movie? Or do you factor in Mark Ruffalo and what has come since for the MCU?
Yeah.
And I think everyone's going to have a different answer for that. You have, as you've mentioned before, you have tons of stuff from the Peter David run that you could really work with. But also, like, Ragnarok is Planet Hulk, you know, put into a Thor movie. I don't think you could do World War Hulk at this point. I don't know that you could even do, like, a Joe Fixit. You know, there's a lot that I'm not sure what you could do, but I also never expected to see Professor Hulk on a big screen. And if we go back to the Norn one, none of that matters either. Like, that movie ended with, you know, he might be accepting that he's the Hulk. He might be okay with it. Who knows? And why is this guy's head growing green and getting bigger? Like, and nothing was done with that since.
Mm-hmm.
So I've just been going through anything Hulk I could get my hands on at the local libraries. I even grabbed one of those giant hardcover DK book publisher things that's like, here's the history of this character, and here's everyone that's appeared before it.
Yeah.
There's a Hulk one. A lot I forgot. Like, wait, you debuted in that book? I had no idea.
Yeah, I love those DK books. Those are awesome books.
Pantheon's weird. Not quite understanding that whole thing. But it's been very interesting to go through, because Hulk was, I always appreciated it. I always, you know, respected it. It was not a book I collected every month ever. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot I missed here, and there's a lot to mine. So I'll be recording that next week, and I'm not sure exactly when it goes up. It's supposed to go up in March, though.
Excellent. No, that sounds awesome. And I would love to see the Pantheon show up in a Hulk movie. I would love to see them do that, because that's one of those unfortunate plot lines that got dropped, unfortunately. And I really don't know if Peter David was ever going to get back to them and bring them back into it. I was kind of hoping he would, but unfortunately, he never got the chance. So.
No, you saw the possible She-Hulk leak, right?
Yes, with Mark Ruffalo appearing in the show.
And the bad guy.
I didn't catch the bad guy.
They decided on a villain. It's going to be Thundra.
Ooh. Interesting.
Yeah, no casting or anything like that announced yet, or, you know, how they're going to do it. But that's the big...
I wonder if they're going to...
The big rumor that's looking more true.
Oh, if they're bringing Mark Ruffalo into it, I wonder if they're going to do the, you know, the blood transfusion storyline, if that's going to be how she comes to be. It'll be interesting. And if it is Mark Ruffalo in there...
You could do that. Yeah, and you could do the, you know, talking and accent blood transfusion. You can even do it as a quick montage, 5 minutes, and then get going.
Yeah, you definitely could, but I wonder, like, with Professor Hulk being in the, you know, in Endgame and stuff, like, is that the Mark Ruffalo we're getting? Or are we getting the Professor Hulk? Or are we getting Mark, you know, like, who knows? She could have came into being during the snap, you know, before he became the Professor Hulk.
Yeah, you could say it took place off camera within the 5-year gap.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely lots of potential. All right, for my brain candy, so last year they relaunched the X-Men comic books, you know, with Jonathan Hickman, being like, you know, the main editor for all the X-Men titles going forward. And I really enjoyed that miniseries he did, where it was the House of X and Powers of X. You know, each one had 6 issues, but it essentially was a 12 issue combined miniseries. And then after that, I didn't really care much for what they were doing. Like, It seems to be kind of like a weird thing going on. Like, I was reading the main X-Men title because it's written by Jonathan Hickman, and then I dropped it because it's really not that good, you know, like, going forward. But there are some good books that came out of that relaunch of the X-Men corner of the Marvel Universe. And both of them, ironically, are written by the same person. I'm really enjoying X-Force, you know, like, they're, you know, doing this, you know, the standard, this is the Black Ops team for, you know, the mutants of Krakoa, but it's being run by Beast. It makes sense that, you know, you would have the smartest, you know, mutant running your Black Ops team, because he can, you know, plan everything out more efficiently than anyone. So I'm really enjoying X-Force, and they've only done one issue so far, but the relaunch of Wolverine is really good. And they're both written by a newish writer. He's new to Marvel anyway. A guy named Benjamin Percy. I know he's written for DC prior to this, and I believe he's a short story writer. I think he has a couple books out there. But yeah, he's just hitting it out of the park. Though, like, without a doubt, like, X-Force is my favorite X-Men book, but Wolverine might actually surpass that. Like, I really enjoy the character of Wolverine. I've never been, you know, like, the biggest fan. Like, I've bought Wolverine periodically over the years. There's certain, you know, writers or artists that will handle that character, and I'll read it while they're working on that character. Ironically, Eric Larson, when in the late 90s, when he kind of came back to Marvel a little bit to do some writing, he did a run on Wolverine that I really enjoyed. That was probably one of my favorite runs on Wolverine. But yeah, this first issue of Wolverine was just phenomenal, and I really like this new writer to Marvel, Benjamin Percy. I think he's doing a really good job. Also, another title that I've been enjoying, and it's being written by, I can't remember the one writer, But Jonathan Hickman comes in and writes the occasional issue, and that's the New Mutants. Basically, it's like an amalgamation of the original New Mutants lineup with the Generation X lineup. Like, there's characters from both those books in this book. I'm really enjoying it. It's, like I said, the occasional issue is written by Jonathan Hickman, and then there's another writer involved. The art's been pretty good on all the issues, so that is what I am reading. All right, so let's move on to our Ender segment, as we're getting to the latter half of our episode. So I have a few things to discuss here. Last episode, I believe I talked about episode 4 and 5 of Picard. I might have been 5 and 6. I can't remember. But since then, episode 7 and 8 have come out of Star Trek Picard. And I have a few notes here. The death count is still climbing. I know on the last episode I mentioned that, you know, there's always a murder every episode. Somebody's getting killed. And that continues. Unfortunately, that is still a thing. You know, a lot of Romulans in this last episode, a lot of Borg got killed. Episode 7, it was an episode, probably my favorite of the series so far, and that's the episode where we had the Rikers come back. We had William Riker and Deanna Troi Riker show up with their daughter, and we got to see these characters that we haven't seen since Star Trek Nemesis. We get to see what you know has happened to them. You know, they started a family, obviously, after they got married. And unfortunately, you know, there was some tragedy. One of their children passed away. And, you know, they're both semi-retired. Riker has a line in this episode where he says he's still in he's still an active reserve member. So he can return to Starfleet at any point, and I think they threw that line in there because I think we are going to see Riker come back as either a captain or an admiral at some point in Star Trek Picard. But it was great seeing Jonathan Frakes and Marina Sirtis playing these characters again, you know, to see their interactions with Patrick Stewart. You know, there was a lot of nostalgia, and definitely hit the itch in the feelers, that's for sure. It was particularly a good episode. And episode 8, that's the one that just was released today. Like I had mentioned in a previous episode, the head of Starfleet Command, you know, was swearing at Picard. And again, she did that in this episode, but she told Captain Picard to shut the fuck up.
Oh, jeez.
But in this instance, it was more in a funny way. Like, it actually, like, she was admitting that she was wrong, but Picard was doing one of his big Picard speeches, and she just wanted to get to the point, and was like, no, I realize you're right, I was wrong, help is on the way. But, again, you know, they're throwing F-bombs out there just for this. To me, it just seems there's no need for all this profanity. I should stress, I'm not a prude. I'm not against swearing. Like, I throw the occasional F-bomb out there in my world, in my real life.
No, but
Star Trek shouldn't.
Time and place for it too.
Yeah, Star Trek doesn't need that, you know. And we're getting more into the mystery of what is going on here, like why, you know. Would Data potentially have daughters? You know, what's going on? Why do the Romulans hate synthetic life so much? You know, we're kind of learning a little bit about that. You know, apparently, you know, they're telling a similar story to Terminator, to Captain Power, and the Soldiers of the Future, iRobot, you know, any of these stories where artificial life turns against their creators, that is basically where we're going. I'm pretty sure that's what's happening here. That, you know, the reason why Starfleet will not, you know, why the synths or whatever, the androids turned against them and destroyed, you know, Utopia Planitia and the Mars colonies, why they blew them all up. You know, it was a Romulan plot, but the reason why the Romulans did that was because, you know, they're scared that synthetic life is going to destroy the universe, because apparently some ancient race where they did that, where they created these androids and they turned against them. Anyway, that's the direction that we're going. I'm almost 100% positive. And we're going to this mysterious world where there's these androids. And I'm kind of wondering, like, if you remember, Kevin, back in the original series, there was an episode called I, Mud, where Harry Mud is basically on an android planet. And there's all these androids, and they want to take over the Enterprise because they want to take over the galaxy.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's the planet that they're going to, which probably is not the case, because I don't know if these writers have ever really watched the original series, so they may not be aware that this episode happened, but they are going to a planet where there's going to be androids, apparently. So when that idea presented itself, that's the first thing I thought of was, well, is it that planet on that Harry Mudd went to? Because that was something that plotline that they talked, that they never addressed in Star Trek after the original series, that there was this planet that they knew about where there are these androids that were created by an ancient race that is gone, and now these androids are left, right? And we're seeing, and this is, it's a similar plotline that's going on Picard, where there was apparently an ancient race that created androids, but now the ancient race, I don't know if they destroyed their androids or what happened, but they left a warning to other races, like, don't pursue artificial intelligence, don't pursue, you know, synthetic life, because they'll turn against you every time. And that's why the Romulans found this planet, and they have this cult of Romulans called the Jot Vash. They're like Tal Shiar, but they're like a section of the Tal Shiar that's, you know, about protecting this secret and to make sure that artificial life does not happen. Commodore O, you know, the head of Starfleet security, who we thought was a Vulcan, is actually half Romulan, and the reason why she infiltrated Starfleet was because of Data, because, you know, the Romulans learned that Dr. Soon had created these androids, so she, you know, got herself into Starfleet so she could, you know, keep tabs on them and make sure, you know, like, nothing, like, it didn't get out of control. And yeah, there's all these plot lines that are happening, and I'm not exactly sure where we're going here. But that being said, you know, I'm wondering if these Harry Mudd androids, and like I said, I never understood why they never brought that up on The Next Generation, you know, because Data was unique, and they, you know, they made this big deal about how Dr. Soon created Data and Lore, and, you know, how it's impossible to create an android like them, but he did it. And I remember thinking, like, well, what about Harry Mudd's planet? Like, certainly Starfleet knows about those androids. You know, like, why wouldn't Dr. Soon or, you know, Bruce Maddox, you know, all them guys, why wouldn't they go to that planet? Or maybe they don't live there anymore. Maybe those androids up and left and nobody knows what happened to them. You know, like, I just, if there was some mention of what happened, it would be awesome.
I don't think you're going to get a clean ending this season.
I really don't think so either, because there's only two episodes left. There's so much to resolve. You know, in this last episode, we, you know, 7 of 9 came back. We saw, you know, her, you know, doing some Borg stuff, which was kind of cool. But it'll, anyway, I'm not hating on this show. Like, there's a lot of Star Trek fans out there that either really love the new Star Trek and really love the show, and then there's other fans that hate it and shit on it, right? And I'm not like that. Like, you know, I don't like Discovery, and I have a bunch of issues with Discovery that I've talked about before. But with Picard, I'm a little softer on that, because in some ways I think they are doing good with this show, but in other ways they're not doing good. You know, like they're ignoring things, and you know, characters are doing things that really don't make any sense, other than it's just bad writing, as far as I'm concerned. But overall, I'm not like The Mandalorian, for example. Like, to go back to Star Wars, you know, when The Mandalorian was coming out, I loved that show. Like, even the weaker episodes, I enjoyed. Picard, every week, like today, for example, the newest episode came out, and I was happy to watch it. But I'm not as excited as I was for The Mandalorian. You know, like, and I should be, because I am more of a Star Trek fan than I am a Star Wars fan. I've always been more Star Trek. Like, I should be, like, giddy every time a new episode comes out. But I'm not really. You know, I'm kind of halfway there, but not the whole way there. If that makes any sense. But,
and I mean, I know that they have to have people from, you know, have people from the shows come in and make their little appearances and maybe move the plot forward. But that's also not letting a show stand on its own, too.
Yeah.
And season two, Mark Bernard, who does Fat Man Beyond with Kevin Smith, just got officially announced as a senior producer on season two. So I know that there's a season two in production, at least right now.
Yeah. And they did announce that before, I think, season one even launched. But you're saying Kevin Smith's co-host on his podcast is going to be a producer?
Yeah.
Huh.
He's co-host for Fat Man Beyond.
Yep.
Which used to be Fat Man on Batman. He wrote for Alphas, which was on Sci-Fi forever ago. He wrote for Castle Rock. And he just came off of Treadstone, which is a Bourne Identity show. That's on USA, maybe? I forget.
Okay.
And then he was wrote 2 or 3 episodes for Kevin Smith's upcoming Netflix Masters of the Universe show.
Okay.
And he's got a real good comic called Genius that came out years ago now from Top Cow. It was insane. I finally read it, and I haven't wrote anything up yet. It's buried now. But the concept of that is every generation there's a military genius.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Genghis Khan, Attila, Hun, Pet, and whatever. What if this generation's military genius is a teenager in South Central L.A.? Hmm. Stuff could happen.
Yeah.
Very interesting stuff. Very real world level stuff. Like, it's messed up. I'm like, if I accept this concept, that's the only fantastic thing here. Everything else could happen. It's a real interesting comic. But he's ridiculously smart. And I listen to podcasts. They'll ask him for reviews on things, and they do, you know, questions from the audience and all. And the way he comes at things is just brilliant. He's the person that got the whole idea of Miles Morales out in the universe.
Hmm.
They said, do you think Spider-Man could be black? When everyone was like, oh, you know, just as we're casting these movies, how many characters have to look a certain way? And some I think do, and some I think you could change, and it doesn't matter. So his, shorthanding it here, his point was, if you told me, here's a story of a teenage boy who lives in Queens, and both of his parents are dead, and he lives with his aunt and uncle, and his uncle dies from gun violence. So all he's doing is using these powers to try to make a better life for people because he has this sense of responsibility and he wants to support his aunt that he lives with and he has relationship problems and he's poor and he wears a mask so no one knows what he looks like. I'm thinking he's black. If you tell me all of that, I'm going to assume this kid's black. I'm like, yeah, I can't argue that. And that put the idea of Miles Morales out there. It changed, you know, form and shape now from his original thing, but Ben just kind of picked up this ball and ran with it. It's like, this is not a bad idea. Mm-hmm. Let me see what a black Spider-Man would be. Hmm. So yeah, if you're looking, I think they just came back with a new episode this week as Kevin Smith's mostly done with the Jane Bob reboot tour.
Oh, okay.
So I think there's new Fat Man Beyond up this week. I haven't listened to it yet.
Excellent.
But yeah, you'll hear this guy's ideas and I think you'll feel comforted that he's going to be part of Picard.
I hope so. I really do. I do think they need somebody, you know, in there that isn't just serving their own agenda. But anyway, every once in a while, you know, like I'm on these, you know, Star Trek fan sites and stuff on Facebook, or fan groups, I mean, and somebody will write something that really resonates with how I feel and what I'm thinking. So I, this guy left this going comment about, Star Trek and, you know, what it should be and what it is. So I wanted to read this. His name is Simon Tremblay. So he starts out, Star Trek is defined by mostly utopian, mostly hopeful, mostly uplifting, mostly did not preach, did not guilt trip, had mostly harmonious and respectful interactions between the crew, still represented a humanity that had made it, that can do better, truly altruistic, built intellectual tension and resolved it within the same or next episode, action served the plot, it was thought-provoking, tension came from outside from the encounters, not internal conflict for the most part. Now, Star Trek Discovery and Star Trek Picard take all of these points, reverse them, take away intellectual tension, replace with emotional / action rides, switch thought-provoking to mind-numbing and preaching, and with internal conflict, and there you have it. Kurtzman Trek is anti-Trek. By any definition of the word, there's no convincing needed. It's just a rational, logical conclusion stemming from a simple objective analysis of the actual content. The target audience isn't the same nowadays. They target people who are either not born back in the days or were a bit young, those who spend the most. They target the Marvel / ADHD audience, so there needs to be lots of emotional rides and action to keep their attention from slipping. So much so that Star Trek Discovery was exhausting to watch for me, literally. I was emotionally spent and felt drained after each episode. And it's after one thing, your wallet. CBS said so themselves. That's it. That's their goal. It's like giving the reins of the show to the Ferengis. You're going to get some crazy shit like reversed themes of dystopia, despair, depressing, dark, wannabe, edgy, slash gritty, etc. Star Trek's goal was vastly different. That being said, are Star Trek Discovery and Star Trek Picard good shows? Probably. Is it Star Trek? Nope. If you want Star Trek nowadays, there are four options. You rewatch the old series slash movies. You watch the fan films. You read the hundreds of novels. Or you watch the Orville. And that was his statement. And that is... I completely agree. That's, you know, and like I said, Picard's a little bit better, you know, like they do a little bit better job with it, but, you know, there's still some issues. And on last but not least, enough with the lens flares. My God. So, like, I didn't think Picard was as bad with the lens flares, but it seems like they're getting worse. Like, they're everywhere now. And I'm so sick of lens flares. Okay, so moving on, I have one more topic of discussion, unless you have anything you wanted to throw out there, Kevin.
Not like I think of right now.
Okay, so my next topic of discussion, and this is, again, talking about a franchise that has a lot of backlash happening right now, and that is Doctor Who. Do you watch Doctor Who at all, Kevin? And if so, have you watched the new season at all?
We watched first one or two with Capaldi, and then just didn't have the time and haven't gone back to it yet. I'd like to at some point. It just hasn't happened. And I think a lot of factors, I mean, one, we don't have the free time that we had previous to the kid. Two, Doctor Who had a long break where he kind of forgot about it. And three, much like many other things, I think when you discover Doctor Who and whoever's Doctor then is your favorite, and eventually you kind of fade off and it's time for someone else to discover it, you know?
Well, fell off with the Capaldi era, but I mean I did go back and rewatch it, and to me, like, I love the Matt Smith stuff, like that was my personal favorite, but the Capaldi was okay, and then they announced what's her name, Whitaker. Oh, I can't remember the lady that's. I'm gonna look it up.
Yeah.
Whitaker's her last name. She came on, and I was actually very excited that she was going to be on the show. Oh, Jodie Whittaker, because I had seen her in it's a British show. And it actually was with David Tennant. I'm drawing a blank on the name of the show. But basically, it's, you know, David Tennant plays like this not an FBI, but like basically like the British, maybe Scotland Yard or something, the British version. He goes to the small town to investigate this murder, and Jodie Whittaker played, I want to say the mother of the kid that gets murdered. That's when I first met her, and I really liked her on that show. I thought she did an excellent job. So when they announced that she was going to be the new Doctor, I thought, great. You know, like, I'm not against a female Doctor. I'm all for change, like, if it's warranted. You know, so typically, you know, the Doctors of the past have been, you know, white guys. I'm all for... You know, the Doctor being a woman, I'm all for the Doctor being a person of color. Like, it doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is if the show is well written. And one of the highlights that I get from Doctor Who is when they can integrate things that happened in the past and make it work. For example, when they did the 50th anniversary special, when they had David Tennant come back, and he was, you know, he did that special with Matt Smith. And then they had, I'm drawing a blank, the Fourth Doctor, that actor, Tom Baker. They had Tom Baker come back for that special, where he plays like the curator of the museum or whatever.
Oh yeah.
And yeah. You know, wink wink, you know, he might actually be the Doctor. And it was awesome. Like I love, you know, how they pay homage to what came before and they make it work. Some of the biggest backlash that is occurring now is in regards to the season finale, where basically they went someplace you should never go. There's certain backstories, there's certain things in pop culture that you really shouldn't go to. Like there should be that mystery. For example, like, you know, I was thinking about this today. I think one of the reasons why Solo, the Star Wars movie, kind of bombed in regards to, you know, it being the lowest, you know, theatrical Star Wars release in terms of profit, and why people didn't seem to gravitate to it and people didn't like it, is because, you know, the idea of, you know, let's do a movie about how Han Solo and Chewie meet. Let's do the story of how they get the Millennium Falcon. Let's get the story of, you know, Han and Lando and their first meeting. You know, like all those ideas in theory sound like a great movie, but it really should have been left to people's imaginations, because no matter what you do, it will never be as good as what people have already thought of in their minds. And I really think that's why Solo kind of failed, right? Like, that was a backstory that they shouldn't have went there, right? And but they did, and it is what it is. With Doctor Who, the story that you should never tell is the origin of the Doctor. You know, what we know about the Doctor is that he stole a TARDIS, that he's a Time Lord from the planet Gallifrey. He stole a TARDIS, and he's kind of like an eccentric outcast to his people. And, you know, he's really likes Earth, spends most of his time there, and he's done a lot of good things, and that's that, right? But in the season finale, they went back and actually told the origin of the Doctor. And I don't know what it is lately with Hollywood, and I'm not against casting females in roles and so on and so forth, but it just seems lately, you know, like you get the all-female cast of Ghostbusters, you get, you know, like it just seems like there's this girl power thing going on, which is cool, like, don't get me wrong, you know, but the original Doctor for, you know, the 50 plus years was William Hartnell, you know, the original Doctor on the original first episode of Doctor Who. Like, that is who they established as the first Doctor. But as it turns out, it's not. Apparently, the Doctor is originally a black girl. And,
yeah. You
know, and apparently it wasn't a member of the Gallifrey race. You know, she just kind of turned up from another dimension or something. And then she fell off a cliff and died and then regenerated. And then the Gallifrey scientists that found her saw that she could do this. And originally she brought her in, you know, because she was just a young girl, and brought her, and I'm paraphrasing here, brought her in, and then when she realized that she could regenerate and not die, this scientist that took her in decides to kill her a bunch of times so she can get her to regenerate, so she can study the regeneration, so she could, you know, basically harness that power to pass on to the rest of Gallifrey. So, as it turns out, the doctor is not actually from Gallifrey, and the doctor is not William Hartnell. The doctor is originally a black girl who, you know, became a different, you know, became like a Chinese girl who became like a, you know, a boy at some point, and eventually ended up as William Hartnell at some point. You know, I just, going back and doing this backstory, it really angered a lot of Doctor Who fans, because people like that mystery of, you don't really know who the Doctor is, you know his basic backstory, you know, like, I think it was on the 50th anniversary, they showed the one scene where you see William Hartnell stealing the original TARDIS, you know, like, they used old footage, and now that's kind of all undone. And, you know, having Jodie Whittaker come in playing the, you know, using air quotes, the first female doctor, now that's undone because the doctor is female, originally. You know, not just that, but, you know, we have, you know, like the different doctors, like William Hartnell's Doctor Number One, Matt Smith was Doctor 11, David Tennant was Doctor 10, Capaldi was Doctor 13, the 12th Doctor. And now that's all done because we don't know how many different versions of the Doctor there have been, because apparently the Doctor blocked that out. You know, they brought Gallifrey back into the show, but now the Master has destroyed Gallifrey. You know, like, because, I mean, it's been destroyed before and come back, and now it's been destroyed again. And anyway, like, there's so much backlash. And, you know, honestly, these last couple seasons, I watched, I think, the first two or three episodes this season, and I just couldn't get back to it. Like, you know, no offense to Jodie Whittaker, I think she would do a good job. I don't knock her as an actress. I think she is a good actress. I just think that she's not getting good scripts to write, or, you know, good scripts to act off of. Like, the writing is bad. You know, like, they do things that don't make sense. They, you know, there's always these MacGuffins that show up at the last second. The companions, I think, could be good, but, you know, like, they're, you know, like, Bradley Walsh, for example, like, I love that actor. You know, he was on Law and Order UK, and he's done a number of British shows. I think he's fantastic as a companion, but they just don't give him anything to work with. Like, it's just a really badly written show now. And now they went too far. They told the story that should never have been told on Doctor Who, and they did it a mediocre story. You know, like not only did they tell the story that you shouldn't tell, but they did it in a crappy way. And
I think...
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry. I think who this retcon of the first actor in the origin and all, I don't think is gonna stand and be true. I think it's a chapter, and then it's gonna find out this was misunderstood, lied to, alternate dimension, you know, someone manipulating behind the scenes, something like that. I really don't think this is sticking.
Well, I don't think it's sticking now. Like, I think they're going to read into they're going to see the backlash and the crappy score on Rotten Tomatoes and all of that, and they're going to say, I don't think we should have done this. But, I mean, it was the Master that gave this reveal, right? So, I mean, the guy could be lying. And
yeah, I think there's an out already in here.
Yes, I'm hoping to go that route. But yeah, this and the thing is, like, when Jodie Whittaker came on, Stephen Moffat had left the show, and it was time for Stephen Moffat to go. Like, he had told a lot of good stories, but towards the end, you know, like, his some of his original concepts and stuff he did, you know, during his time working on Doctor Who, you know, during the Tennant years, like, he wasn't a showrunner then, but he was working on the show. I mean, he did his probably, you know, most famous creation what are they called? The statues that move.
Oh, the
Weeping Angels. Weeping Angels.
Weeping Angels.
Yeah, like, I mean, that episode, that David Tennant episode, amazing. Amazing. And that was, yeah. I think that might have been his first Doctor Who script. Stephen Moffat. And then when Russell T. Davies left, he took over showrunner. And I mean, the Weeping Angels, like, talk about cool concept. And then there, oh, I can't remember those other aliens where, if you see them, you know they're there, but as soon as you look away, you forget that you saw them. You know, the one episode, like, Amy, had a Sharpie, so she would put a mark on her arm every time she saw one, so she would remember that they were there. And then the next, yeah. And then when she looks in the mirror, she's got marks all over her body. Like it was crazy. Like, it, you know, like, such cool concepts. But towards the end of his run, it was like, he was running on fumes. Like, you could tell. Like, it was like, okay, so we need a new guy. So they bring in this Chris Chibnall. You know, and yeah, it's like I said, Jodie Whittaker, I think, would have been an amazing doctor under, like, Stephen Moffat or Russell T. Davies, but because, you know, she's getting mediocre scripts and stuff to work with, you know, by this, you know, Chibnall guy, you know, it's too bad, you know, and you know, and I know from a Star Trek perspective, I can tell you, rewriting canon. Big mistake. Don't go there. Yeah. Like, there's, like, that is the quickest way to alienate your fan base, is when you start saying, oh, you thought you knew? No, you didn't know. It's actually this. And it's like, no.
And temporary ones are fine for a story.
Yeah.
You know, a temporary one that goes back to the big status quo. I mean, little tweaks are always good, but your big truths need to hold still.
Yes, exactly. And on a final note, you know, his name's Chris. He's making all us Chris's look bad. You know, like, like, I really, like, whenever Chris fumbles, it's a big thing for me, you know, like, you know, Chris Pine, you know, when he was doing those Star Trek movies, I'm like, damn it, Chris, you know, you could have done better.
You're better than that.
And now he's doing Wonder Woman, so I applaud him. But, I mean, we do have Chris Evans in our camp. We have Chris Pratt. We have Chris Hemsworth. You know, but when, you know, Chibnall comes in there and is doing this, he's given all of us Chris's a bad name. So, hopefully it changes. Like, I know there's a rumor floating around that Matt Smith is coming back and that there's going to be, you know, And they're it's always awesome when you see different doctors together. It's one of the coolest concepts and one of the coolest things that they can do in Doctor Who is when you get different doctors teaming up. Like, I would love it if they bring Capaldi back. You know, even Tennant. Like supposedly Tennant is up for coming back for a special if it's done properly. I'm just hoping that Chibnall doesn't screw this up. You know, like that is a way to bring fans back. You know, if you bring back their favorite doctors, but if you screw that up, buddy, that's it. You know.
True.
But anyway, let's close out this episode, and we're gonna play that little game of where can we find you on the internet, Kevin? Where can we find you, sir?
Hey, you can find the blog over at masklibrary.com. And you can also look for Mask Library on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Excellent. And I just wanted to... I unfortunately don't have Jason's stuff here in front of me. Jason was with us earlier in the episode, but unfortunately had to leave. He is one of our co-hosts, so hopefully he will be back in a future installment. He was on our last episode that just was released prior to this recording. But if you go to our website, you'll see all of Jason's blog information there. You can check out my blog at randomnerdist.blogspot.com. I'm also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at chrislock1701. Be sure to check out our group on Facebook. We are currently at 195 members at last count. And I'm also the admin at The Incredible Fans of The Incredible Hulk. It is a group on Facebook as well. It's at last count, we were at 1,047 members on that group. So on behalf of Kevin Decent and Jason Roberts and myself, Chris Lockhart, I want to thank you, dear listener, for taking the time to listen to the Pop Culture Pub podcast. This was our Geek Blocked episode, and we will see you again in the not-too-distant future. Good night.